This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Shao Eek. This week, Prime Minister Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad announced that the government will look into changing the death penalty for drug trafficking to a life sentence. This is another step towards reforming drug policy in Malaysia on the back of the Ministry of Health's announcement last year that the government would also be looking at policy changes towards the decriminalisation of drug use. When the chair of the Global Commission on Drug Policy and former president of Switzerland, Ruth Dreyfuss, visited Malaysia in late January, I caught up with her to find out what we can learn from other countries in implementing drug policy reform. Here's my conversation with her.
If we could start first with an idea of what the Global Commission on Drug Policy is, what is the role of this commission?
The Global Commission on Drug Policy is a group of 26 world leaders, former head of states, of government, leaders of the economic and cultural life, and they committed themselves to advocate for changes in drug policy because they thought that after 60 years of mainly repressive policy, some results were more negative than positive. And what was aimed was not realized. We have still more consumption, more substances, more production, and empowering of criminal organization. Our tools are to collect evidence, to publish reports, but mainly also to go and visit countries, on one side to avoid backlash in cruelty and harsh punishment that are not bringing success. On the other hand, to promote health-oriented and evidence-based policy.
Can you describe a little bit about what how the Commission is working here in Malaysia?
We came with a delegation of three commissioners here to Malaysia to meet ministers, Minister of Health, Minister of Home Affairs. We want also to see the mayor of the beautiful city of Kuala Lumpur to see what can be done also on municipality level. But we met also with the civil society because it's very important to listen from the all stakeholders what is going on in the country and also to bridge the experience on the ground with the policymakers on the highest level.
It's interesting you mentioned even meeting with the mayor of Kuala Lumpur. Can you talk a little bit about why that's important, not to just have a top-down approach?
It's very important because the main services given to the population are organized also on the municipal level, even if it is in the frame of the law, financed by a global budget. But the direct contact with the population is often on the lowest level of political power. And our experience in Europe inspires us also because it was really on the city level that the awareness about the problem was the most accurate. I mean, it was the population of the cities who saw people dying by overdoses, saw them really. I mean, they had this direct contact with people being in great health difficulty, marginalized, homeless, and so on.
Can we take a few steps back with something like 20 years of trying to tackle the drug problem? Can we take a historical look at what kinds of measures were used for drug control and what have we learned from that so-called war on drugs?
The experience is different from one continent to the other, but we find in all continents great harm caused by failed policies. Let's begin with, for instance, Latin America, but the other continent is now following this sad experience. It's an experience of violence. It's an experience of empowering criminal organization to an amplitude that they really challenge the state. In some areas, urban or rural areas, criminal organization has the power. No state is longer present. And the violence between criminal groups and the army, between the army and the police, the corruption is one of the consequences of the direct consequence of the war on drugs. In Europe, it was the health issue that was the worst consequence. The epidemic of AIDS, all the kind of hepatitis, but mainly the very cruel hepatitis C, were the consequences, among others, but for a large part of a repressive drug policy who made the people consume, inject drugs in hidden places, in clandestinity without being caught. And this was one of the sources of the contamination, so that the consequence on health was very clear. If you had overdoses, you see that the consequences on the health was very difficult for the drug users, but for their family, for the whole society. So these two experience of negative impact of purely or mainly repressive policies were at the origin also of the work of our commission. But it's also at the origin of, if not a new consensus on the international drug control, because we are far from that point, at least a position of many countries ready to say, yes, we have to put also health as one of the main aims of our policy. We have to put human rights. We have to see the consequences on development. Development, for instance, in rural region where people have no other alternative often than some crush crops that are drug production. So it was a good move to enlarge the aims of drug policy, which at the beginning was just eradicate production, try to eradicate consumption, and fight against criminal organization. On these three levels, we see that it was not successful. So with the other approaches, human rights, health, development, right of for women, protection of youth, you realize a more holistic policy. And I would say this aim of being more holistic in the approach is gaining really, I would say, a large majority of countries, states, societies.
Why do you think, though, it is still difficult to reach that consensus that you were talking about? And you can see, even in this Southeast Asian region, there are countries that are still taking a very hardline approach.
There are many reasons, I think, why there is still the difficulty to re-enter in a negotiation on what drug policy and the international drug control should be. On one side, you have really countries who believe that cracking down with harsh punishment, both consumption, petty crime, big business in drug issues, in drug trafficking, would be the solution. I think they have no evidence that it is working. But, you know, it's a political asset if you can say, I am strong on drugs. But the other reason is also because from the beginning, I think the understanding about what drugs are was very, very low. For instance, the classification of drugs. What is a very harmful drug? And what is a less lenient drug, what is a medicine and what is a drug, is not scientifically based. It's often based, and I have really to stress this, it's often based on prejudice against certain groups of population. For instance, if we take the influence of the US, because the US was very instrumental in this harsh, punitive approach, why was marijuana considered as something, or cannabis as something so bad? Because it was used by Latin Americans, because it was used by poor people in the country, and the prejudice against this population was great. Why is opium, and afterwards, after opium, heroin, which is from the same family, such a bad drug in the eyes of the U.S., because they were the Chinese workers. The Chinese workers coming in millions to the States to build the railways and so, who consumed opium. Mm-hmm. So that it is really also a matter of discrimination and scientific research about these different substances. Very simple definition of drugs is it's a psychoactive substance that is illegal. It's a law definition, it's not a pharmaceutical definition. And the best way to illustrate it is morphium and heroin are very close. One is a medicine, mm-hmm. and the other is a drug, mm-hmm. even if it is more or less the same substance.
Yes.
But with one substance, you make more money than with the others. Because if you are a criminal organization selling heroin, it will be more lucrative than if it is a pharmacy selling morphine.
That was Madam Ruth Dreyfus, chair of the Global Commission on Drug Policy, and she was in Kuala Lumpur last month to hold discussions on drug policy reform. Next up, the five pathways to drug policy reform. So stay tuned to Health and Living BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Yik. Last month, I caught up with Madam Ruth Dreyfus, chair of the Global Commission on Drug Policy, which is a global panel of world leaders and intellectuals who advocate for science-based discussions about humane and effective ways to reduce the harm caused by drugs to people and societies. So Madam Ruth was in Kuala Lumpur late last month to hold discussions with various government and NGO stakeholders about drug policy reform. Here's the second part of my conversation with her.
The Global Commission has identified five pathways to drug policy reform. Can we look at what measures would come under each pathway? So the first one is to put people's health and safety first, and that's the health approach that you were talking about earlier. What kind of health and social interventions are recommended to reduce direct harm from drug use?
Well, first of all, prevention is very important, as it is for all consumption that can be harmful, and we have examples also of how to have prevention in tobacco, for instance. Let's mm-hmm. just say putting on a package of tobacco that it is harmful and that nicotine can kill is prevention. Mm-hmm. So this is a health approach. Mm-hmm. The second element of a health approach is treatment. Mm-hmm. Treatment is very important and can have many different aims. I mean, treatment can really be oriented to abstinence. Mm-hmm. If a person who is dependent or a person who had a large consumption wants really to quit, you can help this person with therapy in institution, out institution, with psychological support, perhaps with social intervention also to help this person to have less problems that brought this person to use drugs. But it can be also considered as a chronic disease, what the WHO tells about drug addiction, drug mm-hmm. dependence. And in this case, if a person is relapsing and relapsing again and have no possibility really to be free from consumption, well, why don't the state give this person what the body of this person really needs? So methadone is what we call a substitution therapy. It helps people to find a good balance in life, as it, in the case of other chronic disease, you are ready to bring the medicine needed for the whole life of a person. It may be also the case for methadone, and for instance in my country, even diamorphine, which is very close to heroin, mm-hmm. can be delivered by a doctor in a day clinic under very strict condition as a medication. So that's treatment, but it's a very large range of treatment.
Mm-hmm. Huh? Yeah.
It can be what is done here in Malaysia in rehabilitation centers, if they are not under constraint, because generally we don't believe that a treatment under constraint will bring very good result for a chronic disease with this risk of relapse. And this is treatment. And then there is what we call harm reduction. Harm reduction is to say people who use drugs are at great risk. They are at great risk of overdoses. And if naloxone is, which is the antidote to heroin intoxication, is available, you can save life.
Mm-hmm.
That's typical harm reduction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But giving the people access to clean injection material
mm-hmm.
is tools is also harm reduction, because they will not be contaminated by other diseases, I mean by AIDS, hepatitis C, and so on. Even if you allow people, for instance, to use drugs, but in a supervised place, what we have now in at least less than 10 countries in the world, but it's working very well, and Switzerland was pioneering in this sense. It's a place where you say, okay, we know that the people are marginalized, living in the street and so on, harassed by the police, harassed by the dealer. If at one moment of their daily life they can rest and they can inject the drug they use in a safe place, it's better. We avoid many, many things that are a harm for their health and for the community also.
Mm-hmm.
So this is harm reduction. There are other measures. We have also to find new ways for new substances like crystal meth, and which is the problem also
mm-hmm.
mainly here.
Yes.
But heroin was a problem, and I think the measures which were taken here are good measures and helped a lot of people to survive.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can I get some clarification on the abstinence? Because that, for a long time, that was Malaysia's approach. Abstinence, and particularly in detention. Is that what you mean by abstinence here?
What I mean with all kind of treatments is that it must be a real contract between the therapist and the patient.
Mm-hmm.
And the contract means that they agree on the aim. If both and the patient first of all say, yes, I want to be abstinent,
mm.
help me to be abstinent, but respect my dignity, because if you destroy my dignity, you destroy also my capacity to be really a man or a woman in full possession
yeah.
of my will and of my personality. It's okay. I mean, it's a very good way to refine the balance in life.
Mm.
But if somebody says, look, I relapsed many times, I think my aim now is not to be abstinent.
Mm-hmm.
My aim now is to refine the balance of my life,
mm-hmm.
To refine the possibility of a good family life, of a good job, and I know that I will need to consume drugs from time to time or on a regular basis. Help me to find this life balance. Okay? That's also a very noble name that deserves to be sustained by a therapy. Mm-hmm. This therapy can be substitution, can be just also a social, psychological, long-term
support
mm-hmm. and so on. Mm-hmm. So if abstinence is under constraint, if abstinence therapy is a negation of the chronic character of abstinence, if it is the solution that is the only one for all the people who are using drugs, mm-hmm. it is not a well-sought approach.
Okay. All right. But that has to come hand in hand with one of the other pathways, which is to end the criminalization and the incarceration of people using drugs. Is that right?
It is very important to see what are the effects of criminalization, and perhaps also what is the logic of criminalization. How far the state should and is legitimized to interfere so deeply in private decisions.
Mm.
I mean, from a Western point of view, it is clear that the state should avoid to interfere if someone is not a threat for others, for the public safety. So this is a position I would say that many countries share, mm-hmm. That the role of the state should be to protect the people but mm-hmm. not to interfere in their free choices. Well, in other countries, and in other historical times, there was a philosophy to say the state has to decide what is the good way to life and to interfere very strongly in the privacy.
Yes.
The question is criminalization bringing something? And is it efficient? Mm-hmm. Can it really allow to lower the consumption? Is it really something that would allow also the health approach? And here I must say, no, criminalization is an obstacle to the health approach
mm-hmm.
because the people are afraid to out their problems.
Right.
The people have no access to the public services. The people are under prejudice, they lose their job, they enter into a vicious circle that made them always more vulnerable and using more mm-hmm. drugs because they are more vulnerable.
Yeah.
And so to break these vicious circles, I think we have to develop perhaps step by step, but to go toward decriminalization or depenalization of consumption,
mm-hmm.
which means also that you have to depenalize the possession for your own consumption,
mm-hmm.
because if not, you are at the same
yep.
point.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, it is key, I would say, to allow a health and human rights approach. What is very important is to stop the way to the judiciary, to stop the way to the jail.
Mm-hmm.
To stop the way to criminal records that will last on the be a burden for the people for their whole life, for job, for housing, for credit, for family life
mm-hmm.
perhaps, for
yes.
keeping the children,
mm-hmm.
the care of the children. So, for instance, in my country, a step was made, I hope it's not the last one, to say, okay, it will be just an administrative fine and a low fine so that the poor people can also afford
mm-hmm.
and not go to jail because they don't pay the fine.
But is there a criminal record?
No.
No.
It's only administrative.
Right.
So no criminal record.
Mm.
It's like if you park your car
right.
A little bit longer than it
sure.
is allowed to stay at the place you parked it. And this is very important because if you think about young people, beginning life with a criminal record, I mean, it's awful.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, just think about having the possibility to study. If you have a criminal record, probably and you are not rich, you will have no means to go to university.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a loss for the whole society.
That's right.
to stop a beginning professional life.
Mm-hmm. Decriminalization is something that Malaysia is strongly considering. I want to follow up on that a little bit more. Because if we decriminalize use and possession, if we have a good public health approach, what about at the community level? What else, what other community-based support and services would we need to ensure that the individual is still well protected?
First of all, prevention has a very important role to play. I mean, leaders, teachers, family members have to say to take once a joint in life is not a crime, is not a sin.
Mm-hmm.
But it's silly if you take every day several joints,
mm-hmm.
because you will not be able to work at mm-hmm. school or so. I mean, it's education, it's prevention. And it's also the need, I would say, to give jobs, to give housing, to avoid marginalization, to fight against the roots mm-hmm. of over consumption or abuse in substances.
Mm.
I would say with a solid and scaled up public health policy, mm-hmm. with the services accessible to all, and with a very low punishment, only administrative, without criminal records, and if possible, without punishment at all for consumption and punishment, I think you have tools to be master of the quality of life of the people, I would say.
So let's look at another of the pathways, which is to ensure access to essential medicines and pain control. How much of drug abuse stems from lack of access to these essential medicines?
The problem of the essential medicine we are speaking about, psychoactive substances, is that they are, in the meantime, medicine and on the list of drugs.
Mm.
They have this
double
double personality. And this means that the control on the medicine is so strong, and the fear that this medicine might at the end be used as a drug and not as a medicine so strong that the access is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
If you think that the large majority of the world population has no access to morphine, and morphine is a very efficient painkiller, because the people are afraid that it might be used for other purposes. But people are dying in terrible pain. Palliative care is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Methadone is difficult in certain countries, even if it is a medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the reason why access to essential medicine is also part of drug policy.
Mm-hmm.
Or better said, that the prohibition of drugs has very huge negative consequences on the access of painkillers and palliative care.
But it is a legitimate concern that a prescription drug could be abused. How do we navigate that to make sure we have that balance?
It is absolutely clear that there is always a risk of over-prescribing and of bringing substances that are prescribed as medicine into the black market. But this is a matter of regulation of the medicine and of the medical professional.
Mm.
In many, many countries, there is a very good control about the use of, let's say, morphine. I would say there is no problem at all. There might be problem of dependence for certain patients, but this is a medical problem to exactly fine-tune the use of this medicine so that the people have the benefit and not the risk of being dependent. But if you think about the opioid crisis in the States, the beginning of this crisis was just a terrible overflowing of the country, and the poorest people in the country, the poorest region of the country, like the mining districts and states where the people have no longer their jobs. And so it was overflowed by pharmaceutical industry who were as bad as criminal organization. They are now on trial. They try to escape by being bankrupt, but they were criminal. They were criminal. They just sought to their profit. Why? Because the control of medical, of pharmaceutical, the control of medical doctors, the control of advertising is too low in the States. I mean, in Europe, you cannot advertise for medicine. Because it must be something that is only in the choice of the doctor and the patient. You have some very aggressive, not advertising, but direct contact with doctors. You can make the doctors being having profit in prescribing some drugs from the pharmaceutical industry. This is a matter of the regulation of the medical profession and the pharmaceutical rights, the rights of the pharmaceutical industries. The pity with the opioid crisis is that when they stopped the prescription, the people were still in pain and they were dependent because they were had such huge prescription. It's a regulation of industries. It's a matter of pharmaceutical industry, of doctors. We have to regulate the markets of all substances that might be harmful. This is the case, and this is one of our pathways for drugs and for medicine and for alcohol and for tobacco and for isotope. For everything that might be harmful, it is better that the states control them, but in a strong way.
Okay. So, you know, that pathway to regulate drug markets, for governments to be in control of drug markets, you recommend that governments should experiment with models of legal regulation of drugs. What would that look like, for instance, for Malaysia?
Well, I don't know how far Malaysia is on this way, but I know for some substances, for instance, who are not very harmful, perhaps Katom or so, the possibility to regulate the market and to allow the farmers to come out illegality under strict control of quality might be a solution, and I think it is under discussion now also in Malaysia, and that would be a very interesting experiment to see how it works, how it can be linked with prevention to avoid that the consumption rises. But for other, it must be very strong regulation. I consider that heroin prescription, medical heroin prescription, diamorphine prescription, which is the same as we have now in many countries, and 30 years of experience in Switzerland, is a kind of regulation. You can access to heroin, but in a day clinic, if you have failed other treatments, if you are recognized as being really dependent on this substance. I mean, it was for us, for Switzerland, a very positive experience because the people found not only a balance in life, no criminality, but also they reduced the amount of the heroin they used, they received, prescribed by doctors. This is a kind, perhaps the strongest kind of regulation. Mm. In between, you have a lot of examples. Tobacco is not so bad. As an example, tobacco has also an international convention pushing the countries to adopt rules protecting the youth, protecting health, protecting the health of people who are not smoking, avoiding that they are in contact with smoke in public spaces. This is quite a good example, I would say. Alcohol, in my view, is a less good example because of the power of lobbies.
Mm.
And when we regulate, we will have to learn from this different regulations model in other fields. For instance, to avoid the lobby activity and the growing industry in this field will advertise, will try to have more customers and so on, will influence policy, and this is one of the challenges. So we have a large range of possibilities, I would say, and all depends about how harmful the substance might be, and what are the pattern of consumption and who is consuming most, so to focus prevention on this population, on this risk.
Okay. And finally, looking at the trade and the industry related to drugs would be to refocus enforcement responses to drug trafficking and organized crime. Can we talk just a little bit about that? And you already mentioned the black market earlier. I guess if you could give an idea, who is the face of the illicit drug trade?
It's quite diverse. I mean, we just had an investigation now in my country about cannabis in one canton of Switzerland. And for instance, for cannabis, you see that you have all kind of markets. You have the very little market of somebody growing cannabis for a circle of people they know very well, without violence.
Yep.
It's just illegal, but it's not a problem.
It's a community.
It's inside the community. You have groups, also non-violent groups, that are bringing from another country and selling it on the Swiss market, and perhaps not for cannabis but for stronger substance, you have real criminal networks coming from Latin America, crossing Africa, but markets where the benefit is so high that all risks are accepted. I mean, between the cost of cocaine leaf in Bolivia, Peru, or Colombia, and what it is on the market in Europe, I mean, you have perhaps a thousand amount more in Europe than for the farmer.
By the time it reaches,
And at all level, I mean, the remuneration is high enough to allow the risk of illegal activities and the risk of seizure. It's very interesting to see, for instance, that the police is very proud to make seizure, and I understand, it's their job.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look on the price of this substance after a big seizure, we had just now in Europe huge seizure of cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
The price of cocaine is reduced and not higher in these days, which means that it had no effect on the black market.
I see.
It was integrated in the business model, if I can say so.
Yes, they've already calculated it in.
It is calculated. You will lose 10%, 20%, perhaps more.
Mm.
Okay, make it stronger.
Mm.
Make the substance stronger. Huh? Make it purer. And you will have exactly the same benefit you wanted to have.
Mm.
So it's not seizure, I think. It's good. It's not bad. Police make the job for which they are paid and they have to do. But it's not the way really to defeat criminal organizations. The way is intelligence, entering into the organization, spying from the inside. And we have police personnel so brave, because if they are caught, they are killed. But to know where, how the business is built, and to find the bosses, and to arrest them. And it will not be generally in the country where the consumption takes place or where the seizures are made. Second, follow the money. Follow the corruption. Fight against the corruption, because the corruption is why the black market can be so efficient. And money laundering. And this is a responsibility for all countries. And I would say mainly for countries with big banking systems, inclusive mine.
Yes.
we made harsher laws. We seized money. But this is the place. Follow the money.
Follow
because
the money.
It's a business. Disrupt the business. That is the most important. And don't believe that harassing the petty criminals, don't believe that the people who are selling at the corner of a street some drugs will bring you to the heads.
They are far.
They are very far. They are people you can meet in good hotels, in good places, well-dressed and so on. Those are the, I mean, the must be the target of repression. And linked with focusing on the heads of the pyramid, it is better also to consider why some people are at the bottom of the criminal organization.
That's right.
Why certain people are selling drug at the corner, little dealer. Why women are swallowing cocaine and bringing it to another country at risk
being
of
used
their
as
life.
Mules,
And these people, if they are caught, the day after, another person will do the same job. So this is a Sisyphus work. It's day after day you can arrest and you will
and
have
and the boulder
people.
Keeps coming down.
Exactly. Yes. So try also to find really proportionate punishment for these people. And I think in this country especially, and let me speak about death penalty, killing these people is a crime. It's not the people who are the criminal, but the state who kills people who are under pressure and not responsible for the whole business of drug, which is a transnational business model that has to be tackled in another way.
Because most importantly, the evidence shows that that is not stopping the trade and the trafficking.
It's not stopping, and it's a source of great sufferance for people and for families.
Okay. Just very quickly now, you know, we've gone through the five pathways. Malaysia is has shown some success in the methadone treatment, the harm reduction with needle exchange. Now we are considering decriminalization of drug use. How important is it for Malaysia to also look at the other pathways? Will our efforts to decriminalize fail if we don't take into account the regulation and the trade and the trafficking?
Well, trafficking still has to be a fight, but a smart fight, not a fight against those who are not
right at the bottom, as you
at
said.
At the bottom, yeah. Yes, I think any step making progress in human rights, health, development, inclusiveness is a good step. So even if the problem is needs an intellectual, holistic approach and understanding about all the aspects, even if it is a step-by-step progress, it's a good progress.
Mm.
So, yes, I wouldn't advocate for the whole package if I can have some in the package. I would say what is most important in my view for Malaysia is really to depenalize, to avoid people to enter in jail where they will not be in a possibility to regain and to be inclusive in the society. It is to stop compulsory treatment that are not respecting the dignity of the people and destroying more their personality than helping them to overcome imbalance in their life. And the priority is also to avoid the death penalty for drug offenses. I would say, in a general way, in my view, well, I am an abolitionist, but I am also pragmatic, and I know what are the political limits. It is quite now a large consensus, not unanimous, but a large position worldwide, that what should be understood under the most severe crimes, which in the international conventions allow countries to continue to sentence to death and to execute people, that when it is not a direct violent crime, murder, intended to be a murder, and a mass murder, I would say, it is not considered as something that should be under death penalty. So drug, and this is also the position of the International Control Board for Drugs, that very clearly said drug offenses shouldn't be under death penalty sentencing.
Okay.
That was Madam Ruth Dreyfuss, chair of the Global Commission on Drug Policy, and she's also the former president of Switzerland. She was speaking on drug policy reform. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.